Hi, I'm Alexandra Snyder, CEO of the Life Legal Defense Foundation. We're a pro-life nonprofit legal organization that protects vulnerable life in the courtroom and the public square. We handle a lot of different types of cases related to the protection of life. So we help people who are harassed, threatened, and even physically assaulted while praying outside abortion clinics. We represent employees who are terminated because of their pro-life views, including healthcare providers and pharmacists who are forced to participate in abortion. We have represented girls who were forced to have abortions by their abusers, and we're currently representing pro-lifers who were wrongfully accused of violating FACE Act, which is Freedom of Access to Clinic Entrances laws that carry severe penalties, including prison time. We handle cases all over the country, and for out-of-state cases, we have an extensive list of local attorneys we work with. In addition to abortion-related cases and cases involving the protection of pro-life views, we also intervene in situations where someone is denied life-sustaining care. And that's what I want to talk to you about today. I'm so very sorry I couldn't be there in person. I would have loved to get to know you, but I had a prior speaking commitment in Southern California tonight. But if you have any questions at all about what we're discussing, my colleagues will be available by remote appearance to address those. Please also feel free to email me at alexandra@lldf.org, and I'll do my best to give you the information you need. Now, I'm going to share with you a typical type of denial of care case that we handle involving a young woman, as many of our cases do. And then afterwards, we'll talk about how you can protect yourself and your loved ones. So we recently represented the fiancé of a 30-year-old woman who was incapacitated after she had an asthma attack. So she couldn't breathe because of the asthma attack. Then she went into cardiac arrest, and that cut off circulation to her brain. And so she had a lot of swelling and ended up being completely dependent on a ventilator and on artificial nutrition and hydration through a feeding tube. She was not in good shape, obviously. I'm going to call her Olivia since I don't want to use her real name. As I said, she was on a ventilator. She required a feeding tube for food and water. And soon after her injury, her doctors began talking to her fiance, whose name is Jesse, about removing Olivia's ventilator. And that would have caused her death. The doctor said the young woman would never recover. He emphasized that she would never, ever breathe on her own again. Her prognosis was really, really grim. Jesse disagreed with the hospital's plan of care, or lack of plan of care, or plan to remove care, and he wanted to continue her treatment. Olivia had had a serious asthma attack the year before and almost died, but she recovered. And after that incident, Olivia prepared an advance healthcare directive naming Jesse as her decision maker. Jesse told the hospital about the advance directive, but he was not able to find the document. I think they had moved or something, and he didn't want to take the time away from his visits with Olivia to search for the directive. Olivia's doctors kept insisting that Jesse authorize withdrawing care. He refused, and so the hospital went and found Olivia's mother, who lived in another state. Now, Jesse and Olivia were involved in a terrorist attack in France several years prior to this, and they were expected to receive a significant financial settlement. The mother, who had been estranged from Olivia for many years, they barely had contact during that time, thought if she could get power of attorney over her daughter's medical care and over her estate, she would get that money. So she had a definite incentive to fight to get decision-making authority over Olivia's care. Jesse called us, and he was finally able to produce the advance directive. We presented it to the hospital, and we thought, that will resolve the problem. This will be over now. But the hospital refused to accept the document. So we had to file a lawsuit against the hospital and against Olivia's mother, asking the court to deem the advance care directive valid and to name Jesse as Olivia's healthcare agent. And at that point, things got very, very ugly. So Jesse is a musician, and the mother's attorney produced some articles that cast a negative light on his character, to say the least. That was not really helpful to our case. We, in turn, dug deep and found that Olivia had been removed from her mother's home at an early age because of horrific sexual abuse by the mother's boyfriend on both Olivia and her two younger siblings, who were actually toddlers at the time. We had to hire a private investigator to confirm what we found, and it was awful. All this time, the court ordered that decision-making be shared between Jesse and Olivia's mother with input from the hospital. And remember, this is the same hospital that wanted to end her life. So, despite her serious brain injury and her very poor prognosis, Olivia had recovered enough to be able to be weaned off the ventilator and was mostly able to breathe on her own. The hospital transferred her to a long-term care facility, which was inadequate at best. I visited her there, and it was clear that this was a place that just warehoused patients and that she was not going to get anything close to the aggressive rehabilitation that she needed to have the best chance of recovering. It was all really, really frustrating. Ultimately, we had to report the nursing home to the Centers of Medicare and Medicaid, and they launched an investigation that lasted over a year. But in the end, after several months of litigation, the court granted our petition. Jesse was finally able to make healthcare decisions without the hospital's or the mother's input. He transferred her out of that nursing home into a facility that was much, much better equipped to care for Olivia and then also give her the type of rehabilitative treatment that she needed. He sends us updates periodically and has told us that Olivia is learning to speak again. She can eat and drink and no longer needs a feeding tube. And towards the end of last year, Olivia was ready to come home. She still has a way to go, and she may never fully recover, but she has far, far exceeded anything the doctor said she would be able to do. Now, when we had our first case like this, I honestly didn't believe that patients would be taken off of care, that they would be denied ventilator support, or even more basic things like food or water or antibiotics, without their express permission, and often within days of an injury. So we're going to talk now about how you can make sure something like this doesn't happen to you or your loved one. And the first thing is, you need to talk to your family members about your wishes in the event you become incapacitated, even if you're young, or I would say especially if you're young. So most of our cases involve patients in their 20s, 30s, and 40s, as I've said, who never contemplated what might happen if they suffered a brain injury because of a car accident or cardiac event or some other type of injury. And I know it's not pleasant to contemplate your own, you know, an injury of that nature and so severely that you cannot make your own medical decisions. But it is really, really important. And a lot of times what happens is that when people do contemplate something like that, they'll typically make an off-the-cuff statement saying that they would not want to live that way. We've had cases where someone will actually testify that the person watched a movie, let's say Million Dollar Baby or something like that, where someone is dependent on a ventilator or feeding tube. And then they'll say during the movie, I don't want to live that way. I don't want to be hooked up to a machine. That is then in court presented as evidence that the person wants care withdrawn, even just a few days after an injury. So it's very important that you think through these things and consider any statements like that you might have made in the past and make it clear to those around you that you actually want care, that those were not reflective of your actual intent, unless, of course, they are. So make it clear, again, what you want. Be aware that asking for mechanical ventilation or a feeding tube may be needed, like as in Olivia's case, only temporarily until the brain begins to heal. The brain is an incredibly complex organ, and the swelling can take some time to go down and enough to even begin to show some signs of recovery. So, and you don't want to deprive yourself of an opportunity to recover by declining that kind of treatment from the outset. Second, you will want to prepare an advance directive. Those are available on the Attorney General's website. They're available through private organizations. Some Catholic organizations have advance directives. I usually recommend that people specifically ask for long-term medical treatment, including ventilation, artificial nutrition and hydration, everything, the works. Because the default now is to start withdrawing these things very quickly. And so you want to make it clear that you want care to continue. You want that to be unambiguous. You should also name someone who can make those decisions for you in real time. And make sure this is someone you literally trust with your life. So again, this is somebody that you have to have an in-depth conversation with, and you really have to have the sense that they understand what your wishes are and that they will fight for you if it comes to that. For example, I would not name one of my own sons because we're just not on the same page on this at all. Now, if you absolutely cannot find anyone you trust to make healthcare decisions for you, and I've seen this happen, you can execute what's called a physician's order for life-sustaining treatment, or PULST. This is a document that allows you to check off what kind of care you want. Now, I don't usually recommend a PULST because an advanced directive with a named healthcare agent is preferable, but some people don't have that choice. They don't have a suitable healthcare decision maker. Or in some cases, the hospital, if you go in for a potentially life-threatening procedure, the hospital will ask you to sign a PULST. And so you need to know what kind of treatment you want. And often, and I'll just kind of warn you about this, often they'll come in. We just had a case like this last week, in fact, where the doctor came in with the PULST and said to the patient, look, you don't want resuscitation. You don't want us to perform CPR on you. We will be jumping all over your chest. We're going to break all your ribs. I mean, just really presented a horror story. And the man, in this case, it was an elderly man, said, no, I don't want that. And he agreed in theory to a do not resuscitate order, which means if he had gone into cardiac arrest during a procedure or just in the hospital, they would not have provided him with any care. They would have let him die. So be very, very careful. If you sign and you agree to a DNR, a do not resuscitate order, make sure that is what you really want after very careful consideration. And in some cases, they will do that. This gentleman that I just spoke of, he had an advanced directive, but the most recent document controls. So if you have an advanced directive and you later sign a PULST, the PULST is controlling. So be careful about that as well. And then also, I want to caution you regarding the advanced directive. Be very careful about using pre-made templates. So healthcare power of attorney documents and trust, for example, often contain boilerplate language that typically says something like, I want ventilation and artificial nutrition and hydration only for a limited period of time to assess whether I will recover, something like that. And as we saw in Olivia's case, doctors did the assessing and they were wrong. So you don't want to be in a situation where you are in advance denying yourself an opportunity to recover. And then on the advanced directive, there will be a place to indicate if you want to donate your organs. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this. It's a whole different talk, actually. But I always caution people not to be on the organ donor registry. And I will probably get some pushback on that, and that is fine. I say if they want to donate their organs, leave that decision to your healthcare agent to make in real time. And again, I know people will disagree with me and some doctors will disagree with me. And if there's doctors in the audience, I would love to hear from you on this. But our experience has been, after handling many, many cases like this, is that knowing a patient is an organ donor can create some perverse incentives when it comes to discontinuing care. And I'm just going to leave it at that. Thirdly, make sure you properly execute your advance directive. In California, you need two witnesses to sign the directive, or you can have it notarized. And neither of the witnesses can be the named healthcare agent. So you need a healthcare agent and then two, what they call disinterested witnesses, to sign the document. Finally, once you have executed your advance directive, give a copy to your healthcare agent, to your friends or family members that are in your close circle, to your attorney, if you have an attorney, and then also most importantly, to your doctor or doctors. Make sure it is part of your medical record. In our case that I discussed earlier, even though Olivia had signed an advance directive, it was not on file with the hospital, which means we had to get declarations from the witnesses. They had to be interviewed by the court to confirm that their signatures were legitimate. Again, I'm so sorry I couldn't be here to talk to you in person. I would love to have met you all, but I hope this was helpful. And as I said before, my colleagues will be available to address your questions. Thank you so much for listening, and God bless you. Bye-bye.